Chapter 10. Since he refused to give me an address on account of Sybil, I couldn't do a thing to help Nick navigate the DFC's morning craziness. And it was crazy. In addition to the usual work rush hour, there was some sort of huge dragon event going on, which, in hindsight, was probably the business my mom had been referring to when she'd told me my dad was in town. We weren't even near the Peacemaker's Consulate, but with so many dragons flying in, every skyway ramp in the city was choked with rubberneckers, gawking as giant monsters of legend flew over their heads. Even Nick poked his head out the window when we drove under a gap in the bridges, his eyes going wide at the winged shadows silhouetted against the bright blue sky. I stayed firmly in the car. It wasn't that I didn't appreciate the wonder, but after this morning's events, I was totally fine with never seeing another dragon for as long as I lived. Thankfully, other than the jam ups at the ramps, we didn't have to shove our way through the upper city's traffic. For someone who refused to use an AI, Nick had a strangely encyclopedic knowledge of the underground's roadways. He made a few wrong turns at intersections where bits of the DFC had rearranged themselves recently, but for the most part he drove perfectly from memory, pulling us into the tiny parking lot of an old-style Americana diner that stood like an island at the heart of a five-way intersection. "What's this place?" I asked, squinting at the neon sign, which was so cursive and curly I couldn't actually read what it said.
"Martinez,"
Nick replied as we got out of the car.
"I'm not vouching for the quality of the food, but I know the owner, so I'm pretty sure you won't get poisoned."
"A ringing endorsement," I said, breathing in deep. "It smells good, though." It smelled like grease and fried potatoes. Exactly as a diner should, in other words. It was busy, too. We'd gotten the last parking spot in the back by the dumpsters. The place was a wall of noise when we walked inside, but it looked like mostly office workers and maintenance crews grabbing breakfast on their way to work. Plenty of people still looked up when we came in, though, and I moved closer to Nick. "Shouldn't we be lying low?" I whispered as we pushed past the crowded bar area toward the booths at the back. Not that I've ever had a bounty on my head, but going into crowds doesn't seem like a smart move.
"Depends on the crowd," Nick whispered back. "This isn't like where we went last night. These are normal people, which means they're too busy to care about us."
He seemed to be right. Every head that had popped up when we'd come in was back down, too preoccupied with food or conversation to care about two more people. What really shocked me, though, was that no one was staring at Rena. She was sitting in a circular booth at the back, taking up the entire swath of the red plastic-covered seat with various toolkits and bags. Her white lab coat was gone, replaced by a black tank top that only served to highlight the artificiality of her chaste silver body. I would have stared like crazy if she'd walked into my restaurant, but either she'd been waiting long enough that the novelty had worn off, or the people here really didn't care. Normally, I'd have bet on the former. But there was nothing on the table in front of her. Not even a cup of coffee. "You'd better have a damn good reason for dragging me out to this grease pit," she snapped when we got close. "Do you know how hard it is to get the smell of fry oil out of synthetic hair?"
"Can't say that I do,"
Nick said, moving her boxes to make room for us to join her in the booth. "I know this neighborhood is well away from Kaufman's sphere of influence," she went on. "But a diner, Nikki. Really? You never eat out. And you know I can't eat real food anymore. Why couldn't we just meet on a corner like usual?" Nick shrugged.
"Opal wanted breakfast."
I blushed at Rena's look of scorn. The automatic apology for causing inconvenience was already on the tip of my tongue when I came to my senses and swallowed it back down. This was not my problem. Wanting to eat breakfast was a perfectly normal thing to do, and I refused to let a sleazy robot lady who'd given up food make me feel guilty about what might well be my last meal eaten in freedom. She and Nick could sit there and be weirdos who didn't eat together. I was going to enjoy my breakfast. With a belligerent glare at Rena, I grabbed the old-fashioned plastic menu and started thumbing through it. Since we were at a diner, pancakes were right on the first page. After doing some quick menu foo, I figured out how to work the combos in order to land a full stack of 5 plus bacon, ham, and coffee while staying within my budget. I even had money left over for the tip. Which was good, because the waitress had my coffee out within seconds of Sybil putting my order into the diner's AR. No one deserved money more than the people who brought coffee quickly. I was sipping in bliss when Nick leaned over the table.
Do you have it?
No, Rena said, waving at the pile of kits and boxes on the seat beside her. I just decided to bring my entire installation set to a place that sells nothing I can use for funsies. Nick gave her an exasperated look, and Rena rolled her eyes. It's been a long night, she muttered. I got interrogated by every bigwig in the Heights about who knocked down their ramp. I froze mid-sip. You didn't tell them about us, did you? Of course not, Rena said, her electronically augmented voice insulted. Tight lips are the most critical component of our business. I'd lose all my customers if word got out that I'd squealed. But that doesn't mean people won't try.
It'll blow over, Nick assured her. People are always getting into fights up on the rims.
Not ones that destroy the infrastructure. The Heights aren't exactly built to code, you know. You could have brought the whole place down. Considering we'd been under fire and no one up there had done a thing to help us, I was having a hard time finding sympathy for the business owners of the Heights. Saying as much to Rena didn't seem like a savvy move, though, so I kept my mouth shut. At least until my pancakes arrived. The pictures had not done them justice. My plate took up the whole table, and it was stacked high with 5 fluffy, golden, buttery pancakes the size of my head. The sight almost made me cry. It felt silly, but I'd been so broke for so long that getting to splurge and eat something I was really excited about felt like New Year's and my birthday rolled into one. I was painstakingly soaking them in the perfect amount of warm syrup when Rena dug into the biggest bag sitting on the bench beside her. Here, she said, setting Dr. Lyle's hand on the opposite side of the plastic table from where I was elevating syrup to an art form. Everything's cracked and ready to access, as requested.
Excellent, Nick said, reaching out to take the hand. What does it hook into?
Rena's synthetic lips quirked. You, I'm afraid. She reached out to tap the base of the hand where the layer of synthetic skin gave way to the naked circuitry that connected it to the wrist. The entire point of hard-coding something into a cyberware unit's VCI is that it can't be accessed externally. I've cracked the DNA lock for you, but nothing can change the fact that that information can only be reached via direct interface. She slid her silver finger over to tap lovingly on Nick's own artificial hand. If you want whatever's hidden inside, you're going to have to put a hand in it, so to speak. Nick winced. I did too. Wait, I said, swallowing my bite of pancake. You mean he has to physically put on the hand? Like on his own wrist? That's why I brought my stuff, Rena said, waving her hand at the toolkits on the bench beside her. I paled. But it was on a dead guy. So what? She said. I sterilized it. Considering I regularly resold cyberware I found while cleaning, I knew there had to be a sterile way to transfer synthetic limbs between people. But I knew where that hand had come from. I'd seen Dr. Lyle's black, rotting corpse on the floor of his apartment and in the morgue. It wasn't an image that got out of your head easily. Or one you wanted associated with things that were going anywhere near your body. Let alone into. From the look on his face, I knew Nick had to be thinking the same thing. When he spoke, though, his complaint was about something else entirely.
I can't, he said. It's a left hand.
My eyes shot to Nick's synthetic arm, which was indeed his right. But Rena just waved the concern away. Please, she said, pulling a small electric screwdriver out of her kit. Who do you think you're dealing with?
I can put a foot on a head.
A left hand on a right arm is no trouble at all.
No trouble for you, Nick said angrily. But I'm talking about me. How am I supposed to drive or shoot with two left hands?
Rena shrugged with a soft, mechanical click.
No idea. Not my problem.
You wanted the info in this hand. I've told you how to get it.
What you do with that is up to you. But I still expect to be paid in full.
My whole body tightened at the mention of money. I'd forgotten we hadn't paid for Rena's work yet. Nick had mentioned she'd be expensive, but I'd just spent my last $15.12 on pancakes, which meant I was even broker now than I'd been yesterday. I was panicking trying to figure out what I was going to do when Nick's face broke into a wicked smile.
Consider it paid, he said. You still owe me for what happened last year. This should make us even.
Rena's fake eyes went wide.
You're calling in your favor for this?
Really?
Nick shrugged.
I know how much it costs to run a crack, and you don't get rich by spending money. Besides, what's the point of a favor if you don't use it?
Rena gave him a nasty look.
And you couldn't have mentioned this before I did the work?
If you'd known you were doing it pro bono, you wouldn't have worked so diligently. Or agreed to meet me all the way out here.
Nick said, his smile going wider.
Fair is fair, Rena.
That didn't sound fair at all to me. But to my surprise, Rena chuckled.
You really are a cheap bastard, she said, shaking her head.
But fine. Have it your way. She put out her hand.
Arm, please.
Nick dutifully stretched out his artificial right arm, and I nearly choked on my pancakes.
You're doing it here? I cried. At the table?
Actually, I was planning to do it down on the bench, but anywhere is fine. Rena gave me a superior smile. That's why cybernetics will always beat flesh, kitten. You can switch them out and change them around however and wherever you want without worrying about fluids or infection or any other nasty biology. If you replace enough, you don't even have to eat. You just keep your batteries full and your nutrient tank topped off and you can go for days. She reached down to wrap her knuckles against her flat metal stomach.
It's so efficient. You really should start upgrading.
No, thank you, I said, bending low over my half-eaten pancakes, which now seemed more precious than ever. Rena shrugged.
Suit yourself.
She grabbed Dr. Lyle's hand off the table and turned around in the bench.
Ready, Nicky?
Nick nodded and scooted around the circular booth until he was sitting directly next to her.
Just make sure I can get it off again.
Don't worry,
Rena said, pushing his sleeve up and moving her small electric screwdriver into place.
It'll be easy as one.
She undid the hidden screws that held his hand to his wrist.
Two.
She twisted his hand sickeningly back and forth until it popped off, leaving only the connective stump.
Three.
She fit Dr. Lyle's left hand onto Nick's wrist and slid it around until all the electrodes were connected. When things were more or less in place, she put one screw, the only one that would fit in the new configuration, back in.
Voila,
she said proudly, reaching for a roll of electrical tape, which she used to finish securing the new hand to Nick's wrist.
It's not in very tight since I didn't want to ruin my creation by drilling new holes, so don't be rough with it. But that should do well enough to reference the information.
That was fast, I said, impressed. Then my eyes went to all the stuff on the bench beside her.
Wait, if screws were all you needed, why did you bring all that other stuff?
In case screws weren't all I needed,
Rena said with a smile.
Always be prepared.
Considering she had a defibrillator pack in there, I didn't want to know about what kind of disaster Rena felt we needed to be prepared for. I didn't have the time to worry about it either.
Nick was staring at his new hand as if it held the secrets of the universe, and I was desperate to know what he saw.
Can you access the info?
I don't know,
he muttered, looking horribly confused.
Give me something to write with.
I blinked, confused.
You mean like a pen?
I think I've got one, Rena said, digging into her bag. Here. Nick took the cheap ballpoint and pressed it against his paper napkin. He started to write a second later, but I knew from the way his hand jerked that Nick wasn't the one controlling it. Nick's movements were always precise, like a finely tuned machine. These were small and janky. Writing a series of numbers across the paper napkin in the same chicken-scratch cursive I'd seen in all of Dr. Lyle's notes. Nice trick, Rena said when he lifted the pen at last. What does it mean?
I have no idea, Nick said. The hand wrote that, not me.
I scowled at the numbers. They looked familiar, but I couldn't put my finger on where I'd seen the pattern before.
I know,
Sybil said in my ear, her voice desperate to prove that she was still useful.
Those are three-dimensional coordinates.
They're coordinates, I said out loud so the rest of the people at the table would know what was up.
Coordinates to what? Nick asked.
A location in the city,
Sybil said, bringing up a map of the DFZ.
Here.
She lit up the spot in question, and I shook my head.
That can't be right.
What can't be right? Rena asked eagerly, getting into it. Where is it? Since Rena had AR, I had Sybil put the map up in our shared space. Nick still wouldn't be able to see it, but at least I'd only have to explain this insanity to one person.
The point is straight down, I said,
flicking my fingers to scroll the map down until I reached the red dot marking the spot.
Almost a mile underground. There's nothing that goes that deep in the DFZ. You'd hit the water table.
Nick took all of that in with a stoic frown. Then he winced.
Wait,
he said, moving his new hand, or more accurately, letting the hand move him, back to the paper, where he wrote down a second string of numbers in the same chicken-scratch cursive.
How about that?
Sybil put the numbers in as soon as they appeared. Sure enough, it was another set of coordinates, but it didn't fix the problem.
It's still underground, I moaned, sliding the map down even further this time. Just in a different place.
Can you try again? Rena asked.
No,
Nick said, sounding as frustrated as I felt.
I wasn't giving it a second try before. The pressure just moved, and then the numbers were different.
Pressure? I asked.
What kind of pressure?
Nick shook his head.
I'm not sure how else to describe it. The hand's a hand. It feels weird because it's not mine. But it doesn't move unless I tell it to. Even when I'm holding it still, though, there's a pressure in the palm that keeps shifting. Like string on a balloon.
Or a needle in a compass, Rena said excitedly. That hand's not built to plug into an artificial brain enhancement, so it doesn't have a complex input array. It still has to communicate the information somehow, though, and pressure point feedback is a classic. I bet it's pointing you at those coordinates.
Well, if that's what it's supposed to do, then it's broken,
Nick said angrily, clutching his new hand.
Stupid thing keeps jerking around.
Maybe it's not jerking around, I said, staring at my map. Maybe the thing it's pointing at is moving.
That's impossible, Rena said. Even the DFZ doesn't move that fast. The DFZ doesn't, I agreed. But the gnarls do. Nick arched a skeptical eyebrow in my direction. Rena was less polite.
Don't be so gullible, she scolded. The gnarls are an urban legend. The whole thing was made up to sell overpriced maps to tourists.
No, they're not, I said sharply. They're a real phenomenon. I couldn't fault them for their skepticism. The gnarls did sound pretty sketchy, and knowledge of them
was horribly abused by the tourism companies. But while almost all of the stories about a secret network of ever-changing tunnels below the sewers were false, the Gnarls were a concept that was firmly rooted in spirit theory, which also happened to be the only magical theory class I'd actually done well in.
Okay, so everyone knows that all spirits have a domain, right?
I said, looking around the table to make sure they were following. A domain is whatever they're the spirit of, the place or concept that fuels all their power. For a spirit like Algonquin, it's pretty obvious. She's the Lady of the Great Lakes, so her domain is the lakes. It gets more complicated when you're talking about conceptual entities such as the Empty Wind, but the general idea is always the same. Whether it's a physical location or a concept like the Forgotten Dead, every spirit has a core that binds them together. Somewhere all the magic that makes them tick can pull together. But the DFC is a little different. Like the Empty Wind, she's a concept. The idea of a city where nothing's illegal and anything is possible. But she's also a physical place, which is the city we're in right now. That duality means that the DFC has both a physical domain and a conceptual one. Everyone following so far?
I think so, Nick said. I just don't understand why it matters.
It matters because she's a blend, I said. Spirits of the land are rooted in the land. With them, what you see is what you get. But the DFZ was born from humanity. She's the sum of all our concepts about what the DFZ is. That's why she's able to move buildings around like puzzle pieces instead of relying on geological forces like other physical spirits. She's god of both the physical city and our ideal of the city. When you shove the physical and the conceptual together, you get an area of overlap. And that place is the Gnarls. The University of Michigan has 3 whole labs dedicated to studying the phenomenon. It's totally legit. And a fantastic place to hide a ritual. I'd never been to the Gnarls myself, but according to the papers I'd had to read for class, they were an ever-changing labyrinth where the physical and magical worlds had been squished together during the DFC's awakening as a spirit. They were locked in a state of constant magical flux, which meant that no matter how much magic you cast, no one would ever be able to trace it through all the background noise. It was the perfect hiding place. So much so that I felt like an idiot for not thinking of them earlier. This is great, I said, looking at Nick. Normally the Gnarls are unnavigable, but your new hand points to where we want to go. That must be how Dr. Lyle didn't lose his ritual sight every time the Gnarls moved. He put a compass in his hand. That would explain the weird spellwork I found on the inside, Rena said, nodding sagely. I stared at her.
There was spellwork inside it? Why didn't you mention that earlier?
Because it's very common in cyberware that belonged to a mage, she said with a shrug. Every spell slinger with a fake limb tries to jimmy that thing with spellwork to improve the magical throughput. I thought this was just a really bad attempt. But a compass makes way more sense.
So I just follow this pressure, Nick said,
staring at Dr. Lyle's hand as if he was afraid it was going to start punching him.
And this thing will take us to what we're searching for?
That's my theory, I said, nodding.
Great,
he said, sliding over in the booth until he was bumping into me.
Let's go.
He was clearly in an enormous hurry. So was I, but I couldn't go just yet.
Please let me finish my pancakes first, I begged. I already paid for them.
Nick gave me a scathing look, but he settled back into the booth, waving at me to go ahead. I ate in a fury. Honestly, I was already full to the point of discomfort, but I'd spent the last of my money on these, and there was no way Nick would allow a to-go box full of pancakes covered in syrup into his car. They went into my stomach, or they'd go into the trash. So I ate until I was bursting, shoveling pancakes into my mouth until the smell of syrup started to make me nauseous. Only then did I stop, dropping my head against the cushy back of the bench with a groan.
That was impressive, Nick said. Horrific, but impressive.
Do you want the last few bites?
I asked, nodding at the final half a pancake swimming in the syrup of its fallen brothers.
No, he said firmly. After that, I don't think I ever want to see a pancake again.
I was also okay with never seeing, smelling, or even hearing the word pancake again, which I took as a sign I'd gotten my money's worth. Satisfied that I'd spent my last dollars in a fit of excess truly worthy of the DFZ, I hauled myself up and started waddling toward the door with Nick hot on my heels.